Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The National Book Critics Circle just announced this year's winners. Among those recognized were Edgewick Danicat for her story collection, Everything Inside, for fiction. Chanel Miller was awarded an autobiography for Know My Name, her book about being sexually assaulted by Stanford University student Brock Turner. And Morgan Parker's Magical Negro received the National Book Critics Circle Award for poetry. Upon finding out, Morgan tweeted, "Holy bleep, I honestly don't know what to say. I work so hard. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. This is for all the blacks." In Magical Negro, she probes stereotypes, archetypes, all kinds of types, facets of black Americans' life, from historical attitudes to raw accounts of what she calls everyday blackness. We were happy to have Morgan Parker as a guest when Magical Negro was published, and I began by asking her when she knew she wanted to be a poet.
Pretty recently, actually, in the scheme of things. I always wanted to be a writer, but I never really liked poetry. And I still am kind of like, do I like poetry? I always found it super boring and alienating, as most folks do. You know, I grew up in California, and we're reading Robert Frost, and I'm like, I've never seen snow. Mm-hmm. I don't know what cabins look like. You know, it's very... and it's reading poetry was like, I'm not meant to understand this. This is not even for me. The best I can do is pretend that I understand it to seem smart. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I got to college that I saw that there was more to poetry than that, which really excited me. And so my whole career has just kind of been responding to that and trying to make work that, even when it's difficult, isn't alienating or being, intentionally obscure, really trying to connect and actually speak to the person on the other side of the book, as it were.
Were you planning on doing a different kind of writing? Did you want to write short stories or nonfiction?
Yeah, I don't know. I was a kid. I wrote everything down.
Really?
Yeah. I guess.
Or like as an escape?
Yeah. Because that was my thing.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm a writer. I didn't know what that meant. That part I figured out later. But, you know, that was just my thing. That was my way of being in the world. I guess I didn't have a plan. I mean, in my world, it didn't feel like a possible job to have. You know, I guess I was like, maybe I can teach, maybe I can be a journalist, or, you know, it just isn't like a job. Mm-hmm. And especially not coming from, you know, my family's not like academics, they're not artists. So it really, for me, my life since then has been figuring out, okay, how do I hone this craft and find a way to put it into the world? That works for me, you know, so kind of building my own path around that.
Well, you mentioned when you went to college, and you have all the fancies, you know.
I have all the fancies.
Bachelor's in anthropology and creative writing from Columbia University, and MFA in poetry from NYU. So those are the degrees, and that's how you learn to write, or at least you sort of learn the craft, and then you write. When did you realize, okay, I can do this?
About the time, it almost was immediate as soon as I thought, I have to do this. Mm-hmm. I think I had a lot of insecurities and concerns when I first started writing, and especially in my MFA program, about that I wasn't doing it the right way, you know, despite my, you know, fancy credentials, that I still wasn't enough to enter the capital P poetry conversation, I call it. That I was writing work that's like quotes Jay-Z, and so it doesn't sound like poetry, or, you know, that this other people's language. And there was a point where I remember going into workshop. I tried really hard to write a poem that sounded like a poem, you know, from an anthology or whatever. And it was so bad, Allison. It was so bad. And, you know, it was like I was just plugging in words that sound pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after that that I was like, okay, clearly I can't do that. And if that means that I can't be a poet, I'll figure it out, because the things that I'm writing, I clearly have to write. Will they be published? Not sure. Will I figure out a new thing to call them? Not sure. But I think that was the minute that I was kind of like, screw it, and I'm going to do this anyway. That was the minute that I feel my confidence started picking up, and my career kind of went ahead from there.
It's a moment you decided it was okay to be authentic.
Yeah.
You just let yourself do what you needed to do to write what you needed to write. My guest is Morgan Parker. The name of her new collection is Magical Negro. What were some of the poets that you studied that influenced you and made you feel hopeful? And then if you could just give me one poet in the canon, you said hard pass.
I'll start with the latter. I get a lot of flack for this, and I do feel a twinge of guilt about it, but I have never liked Emily Dickinson. I'm sorry. I'm just going to say that to the world. I'm sorry. The dashes
don't
are kind of cool, you know, but definitely she was one that when I approached her work as a young child, was like, I don't know what this lady's talking about. And she seems weird. So, though, you know, I do feel like there's value in her work. It was one that I never got into. My kind of particular canon, oh man, it runs the gamut. Everyone from Allen Ginsberg to Lucille Clifton, Gwendolyn Brooks, June Jordan is a favorite of mine. Nikki Giovanni was a poet I read really early on. Mm-hmm. Bless her attitude for, you know, for co-signing mine, you know. Those are some of the big ones for me. Frank O'Hara, the New York poet himself, also, you know, famously authentic.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, the title of your book. I think for some people it might be off-putting because of the language, and other people it just makes you kind of laugh. You kind of do the like, uh-huh. Will you explain to folks who don't understand what the magical Negro trope is and why you decided that seemed to fit for this collection?
Yeah, I'm very interested in that trope, that idea. And it's something that once I recognized it, I kind of couldn't stop seeing it and seeing all the different ways that it was showing up. I think in movies, it's easily recognizable. I always think of like Bagger Vance, you know, because here's a person that's literally helping the white person throughout the movie. I think often they play this really essential role in like the American narrative where like they just appear when you need them and like set everyone straight, and then they're gone. And their, you know, their personality, identity, particular concerns are never really delved into. They serve a purpose. Mm-hmm. And it is it's a facade, you know, in so many ways. And I think recently there's also this like empowerment of black girl magic and all these things, which I'm for, but I also think requires a lot more nuance, and it's easy to call black people magic. Like how could they not be magic? We mm-hmm. deal with so much crap every day. Mm-hmm. But what does that mean? And mm-hmm. how can we be magic but also real? And like we have bodies that expire, you know, what is that? How can we talk about that? And how can we redefine what magic means? I think there's a temptation to take magic to mean like indestructible or flat, mm-hmm. Uncomplicated. And I don't feel like any of these things. So, you know, I really wanted to play with expectations of black womanhood, definitely. And also think about rewriting my own kind of canon of magical Negroes. If I were to make a list of magical Negroes written by me and not by, you know, a kind of white gaze, who would be the kind of magical characters carrying me through my journey, whether they be complicated, damaged, you know, familial, a specific moment from a movie, you know, mm-hmm. a one particular photograph, trying to get at the specificity of the moments that define me and my particular blackness, and that have helped define my identity building. I think a lot about how many of us as Black Americans don't have access to our origins. And what I always say is, since there's no documents otherwise, whatever I say is true. So, you know,
it starts today.
Yeah, just what you can't say prove me wrong. So I do think a lot about myth making and taking the tools of archiving and documentation, but playing with it and kind of scrambling it up and making it in my own language, I guess.
There's a great deal of you can tell that you are someone who is interested in anthropology as well.
Yeah.
It really is woven throughout your work. Why do you think those two things work so well together? I don't think it's a natural thought of poetry and anthropology.
Yeah, I know. I like doubled majored and everyone was like, that's weird. So you had one useless degree, and so you decided, just slide another one. No, I, you know, I went to college intending to be an English major because, you know, I'm a book nerd. But turns out I'm a different kind of nerd. Mm-hmm. I, you know, I'm not so interested in the science and more sociological data finding, but I remember opening the course catalog and it saying, the study of human beings. And I was like, yeah, what? We're weird. Like, mm-hmm. why do we do the things that we do? For how long have we been doing them? How do we interact with each other? Why? Yeah, like, what are our differences and capacities? And that kind of observation of human life is central to my writing practice. So it has been kind of a pairing.
Mm-hmm.
That has helped define, I guess, my voice and the way I go about writing poems. It's definitely shows up a lot more in this book than my others, I think. And I think there's just like a level of nerding out and being rigorous mm-hmm. and just flexing that language. There's a few poems that use really kind of like academic language.
Well, one of the sections is Negro field notes. Field notes are what mm-hmm. anthropologists go out and take.
Absolutely. And I wanted to make that point of this is documented by me. Like, and that is scientific. Like, that is valuable data. My life experiences are valuable data. And I think that's something that a magical Negro is always, that's waved away, you know? No, you didn't. That's not what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
All of that, you know, I really wanted to strip away not the emotion but the I guess sentimentality or language that's used to persuade. I just wanted to present things as fact, and I almost, you know, there's something about going back to the language of like Foucault or something mm-hmm. in order to feel that the reader will hear you in the right way. And I think that was something that I wanted to play with as well. Lest you disregard, you know, my voice, let me take a different tone that you already see and hear as authoritative.
Mm-hmm.
And also, so two things happen. You know, you hear it more and you hear it in a different kind of way. And then you wonder why. You can only, you know, it takes that particular language for you to trust the statement. Does that make sense?
It does indeed. My guess is Morgan Parker, the name of her book is Magical Negro, which I every time I see it, I have you is good, you is kind. Sorry.
Yeah.
would you actually read a poem for us? It's the last poem in the book.
Absolutely.
And it relates to what you were just saying because it's taken from a Gertrude Stein statement. It's let's use that as the highway in. What do you want to tell us about this before you read it?
I guess that there is, yeah, the title comes from a larger quote from Gertrude Stein's Three Lives, which is also the epigraph in the book. Also, I guess that Angela Davis's teeth is in this book like several times.
Yes, a lot of teeth.
Yeah. So I don't know. I guess you'll see.
All right. This is Morgan Parker.
It was summer now, and the colored people came out into the sunshine. They descend from the boat two by two. The gap in Angela Davis's teeth speaks to the gap in James Baldwin's teeth. The gap in James Baldwin's teeth speaks to the gap in Malcolm X's teeth. The gap in Malcolm X's teeth speaks to the gap in Malcolm X's teeth. The gap in Condoleezza Rice's teeth doesn't speak. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard kisses the Band-Aid on Nellie's cheek. Frederick Douglass's side part kisses Nikki Giovanni's Thug Life tattoo. The choir is led by Whoopi Goldberg's eyebrows. The choir is led by Will Smith's flat top. The choir loses its way. The choir never returns home. The choir sings funeral instead of wedding. Sings funeral instead of allegedly. Sings funeral instead of help. Sings black instead of grace. Sings black as knucklebone, mercy, Junebug, sea air. It is time for war.
My guest is Morgan Parker. One of the things that's so interesting in your work is you do not shy away from a pop culture reference.
Oh, never.
Never. How are you ever concerned it's going to date your work?
That's something that people have been asking me forever. And first of all,
sorry. It's one of those questions. You think about it.
I know.
Because if you read old articles,
yes.
In some ways it helps because you know the point in time, but that sometimes it does feel odd.
Mhm. It's never been a concern of mine. I'm not trying to make art that is outside of time. I see my mission as to reflect the world around me. And it would be weird if I didn't mention pop culture. Also, we have Google now. You know, I remember the days of reading The Wasteland and having to have another book or a whole course just to figure out, you know, the context clues. This is easy. You could Google Beyonce until the world ends, you know. So, yeah, it feels really important to my work. It's just honest, and it's often an easy way to communicate a lot of the concerns that I have without doing this kind of obscuring gymnastics to, like, relate the feeling of seeing a notification about a black man's death to, like, a tree. You know, there's just no other way to describe this world, you know?
I have to ask with the title, There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyonce. Did the Beehive come after you?
A little bit.
I worried about you when I read that.
I cried only once, and it was like some teenagers on the internet hurt my feelings.
Well, because they're the best at it.
I know. Truly. I've learned this. I'm never crossing them again. It's so funny because I never thought that I would have any issues until the book was, like, printed. Someone was like, oh, man. And I was like, what? I made a statement, which I don't think that Beyonce would even argue with. Like, she's seen the ocean, you know? She had a baby. Like, there are other things that are beautiful. And I think it's so interesting that everyone latched onto it as, like, Beyonce is not beautiful, because in no way do I say that, you know? I always say, you know, I don't have a death wish in that way. Like, I'm not, I would never say that. It's really meant to be, like, yes, Beyonce is beautiful, but so are you, and so am I, and so is the sky, and so is having breakfast with your parents, you know, like little things that I think it scares me that we often think this is the most beautiful thing. It's this larger than life idea of a person that I will never encounter in my everyday life. You know, if that's the most beautiful thing, then what are we all up to? We have to be able to experience the most beautiful thing on a daily basis, and to expand our idea of what the most beautiful thing is. So, you know, no shade, obviously. I love Beyonce. And so to the teens who noted that I'm not as cute as Beyonce, I know. I know.
You're like, yes. And?
That wasn't, I didn't know that we were debating that. Stop posting pictures of me.
One more question before I let you go. I asked you when you first came in off mic, did you move to California because you were a New York person? And the reason I know that is because there were all these literary people ooing and aahing over your apartment. It was on some website. And everybody's like, I can't even read her book. I'm looking at her apartment. Are you, have you written it a lot since you've been in LA?
I have, yeah.
Has it changed the way you write? It's such a different vibe.
It is. Yeah, it's quieter. And it's also quieter for me. I lived here for 12 years. It feels like I know everyone. You know, there's a lot of stimuli. And so I really had to sit with myself in the quiet as I started writing in LA. I will tell you that I'm writing things that are longer. I was finishing up a novel when I moved, and it felt like the right place to write prose. There's something about the expansiveness of the land that makes its way into the work. I enjoy it. It's very different, and I don't think I'll ever be able to let go of, you know, be in my mind being a poet in Brooklyn. Like, that is, that's a lifelong badge, I think. But yeah, it's actually been lovely.
Morgan Parker, it's a pleasure to meet
you. Thank
you. You're very excited for you. Your book is on like everybody's most anticipated books of 2019. So
we'll see what happens when they read it.
The name of the book is Magical Negro.